Yes, yes, y'all. Vibe Collective, CAUT 89.5 FM. I am Jams, and joining me in studio,
Luam.
Molly, a.k.a. Docu Vixen.
Adrian Griffin Wall.
Norman.
Yes, welcome, Norman. Welcome to the Vibe Collective.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here.
And Victoria Grant.
Yes, we're the Vibe Collective, heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have roundtable talks. We talk about things like social justice, decolonization, identity, resistance culture, environmental racism, injustice. Shout out to Kembe.
Love.
Yes,
love. Intersectionality.
Yes.
And let's just call it what it is. Celebrity gossip.
Yeah, I'm not going to dress it up today.
No.
It's a rainy day.
It is. It's a day for the straight goods, which is what we will be bringing you today. I do want to properly welcome Norman Otis Richmond to the Vibe Collective. We've been working on this for a while.
Thank you for inviting me.
We're really happy that you're here. And on the phone, Luam, do you want to introduce our guest that we have on the phone today?
Sure. So we've got Kali Okono today with us. He's an organizer, a writer, works with the Malcolm X grassroots movement, and is also currently working with the Lumumba administration in Jackson, Mississippi as a staffer. And we're going to be talking to him today about Black August, about the work of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, about the New Africa movement, and the Black radical tradition. And we're doing that because today marks the closing of Black August, so we want to make sure that we take the time to reflect and look at where the state of the Black community and communities are in the diaspora on the continent and the interconnecting struggles around that.
Yes, so let's welcome Kali to the Vibe Collective. We have him on the phone. Welcome, Kali. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for life and pleasure to be here.
Amazing. All right, Kali, so maybe we can start with you telling us what you're currently working on right now, what you're up to, and how you got involved in organizing.
Well, what I'm primarily working on right now, two primary kind of campaigns or front of the struggle that I'm really kind of concentrating. One is the Jackson Plan, which is the reason why I'm now a staffer in Jackson, Mississippi, and the Chokwe Lumumba administration. And that is a long-term strategy and plan that we've been working on now for the past 10 years in this current kind of form, or current iteration, to really build some power, some people power, some grassroots power for our people in Mississippi and throughout the southern region. The second major thing that I'm involved in is a campaign called the Every 28 Hours Campaign. And that is based upon some work that myself and several comrades in the Malcolm X grassroots movement and the Malcolm X Solidarity Committee has been working on to just kind of chart the extrajudicial killing, that is, the killings of African people, Black people, by the police in the United States, or folks who kind of have some form of thing. Sanction to be able to kind of hunt and kill our people, and there were over 313 of those in 2012. So part of that was documenting that work, and the other part was raising some demand, not only for things such as community control of police, but for more serious kind of structural reform and more democratic control over institutions in our various communities. So those are the two main areas that I'm currently involved in, you know, trying to do some major work in as it was the Malcolm X grassroots movement. And as for me, how I got involved, I would say it really, a combination of family history and being raised by folks who were involved in the struggle, engaged in the struggle to make sure that the children, including myself, were educated and aware. And the other part, I think, is just having to be part of the time and period that I was growing up in the 70s and 80s and the things that I was exposed to, particularly the chemical warfare that was being perpetrated against the African community in the United States during the 70s and 80s. It really kind of raised my passion.
Okay. So maybe you can expand a little bit more on what the Malcolm X grassroots movement does, how it started, and what the Malcolm X grassroots movement is currently working on?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Malcolm X grassroots movement is the child, really, of the New African People's Organization. And that organization really itself is the product of the merger of several organizations, including you have members from the House of Umoja, the Revolutionary Action Movement, and the African People's Party. They came together in 1983 and 1984 to found that organization. And then that organization in 1990 founded the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, really to be a mass association of the New African People's Organization, a mass organization to bring people in. I joined the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement in the 1990s. And since that time, we've been focusing on community organization, primarily against police brutality. We've also been trying to struggle for economic development and self-determination for African people throughout the communities, African communities throughout the United States. But we're concentrated focus on what we call New Africa, which is the southeastern portion of the United States, where the greatest number of African people in the United States have been historically concentrated and are still historically concentrated. And then, you know, some of the other work that folks may know that we've done, a tremendous amount of work in over a decade, is work around political prisoners, prisoners of war, political exiles. We've also done a number of different things in terms of the cultural arena, particularly around promoting Black Organ International Hip Hop, kind of cultural exchanges. And we've done just, you know, a number of different things in terms of, here more recently, confronting environmental racism, fighting for food, sovereignty, food justice, fighting against the whole criminal justice system and its impact on African people. I mean, you name it, in terms of some of the fronts of struggle over the past 20 years we've been involved throughout the United States. But those are the areas I think we've probably done the greatest concentration of focus work in.
And one of the, speaking of the work that you've done around the prison industrial complex and the effects of policing on Black communities, can you talk about the report that the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement recently issued around the extrajudicial killings of Black people in the United States?
Mm-hmm. The last report that we did, and which, you know, folks can find on our website, www.mnbn.org, the official report is called Operation Ghetto Storm. And that comes from a series of trainings and promotions that several police officers did really in the 1990s and the early part of 2000, where they were taking the campaign that they launched against Iraq, Operation Desert Storm, in the early 1990s, and were applying it to the urban settings in the United States, targeting African and Latino communities in particular. And with that report, which, you know, we had done an exhaustive study of all the different media sources, the police reports, reports from the FBI, etc., to try to really get a solid tally, since no institution in the United States keeps these information or records. We were trying to gather all the information of all the different African people who were killed in the year 2012. And we started off because we just noticed that there was a tremendous kind of spike in the killings that were beginning to happen in 2011, early 2012. So we wanted to just educate our people, number one, and make the public more aware, number two, that this was going on. And in the course of the year, and beginning of this year, 2013, we completed the report. You know, we documented there were over 313 African men, women, and children that were killed by the police in the United States. And we know that there were more, but we just couldn't validate, you know, the total numbers just given the resources that we have, the human resources, and this was all volunteer work and was paid for it. But that's what we were able to sustain here. We put that out. And, you know, what that 313 people killed came out to be was that one person in African descent in the United States was killed by the police every 28 hours. You know, that's a little bit more than one a day. So, you know, we really have been working hard to get this information out. And more than just getting the information out, the other piece is to organize our community. And we did a second piece called Let Your Model Be Resistance. This is an organizing manual that is kind of a toolkit we wanted to provide to the broader movement on how to organize our communities for self-defense and how to build autonomous institutions in our community to hold the police in check and also to use it as a kind of a bottom line space within our communities to negotiate their internal conflict that we have. Oftentimes, we hear many people talk about whether it's just me killing, what about the black-on-black crime, or so-called black-on-black crime, or internal violence within the community. We take both of them seriously, and we know that they're both interrelated. And so, to further that kind of organizing drive, would be the third piece, all of which can be found again on the website, which was Recharge Genocide Again, which is a curriculum that we put together to support the report that can be used in high schools and colleges. So that's some of the major work that we've done in 2012 and 2013. And the main point is to really get our communities organized to fight against, you know, white supremacy and the terrorists and Iran against us in the United States and really throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So for our listeners, we've started the hour off by letting them know that this is a show that we're doing in order to reflect on Black August, as August is coming to a close. And for the listeners who are not aware of the history of Black August, can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, Black August, you know, in short, I mean, it's a rich history, I think, that deserves, you know, all the programming they can get. But Black August resistance, it starts with denoting the resistance that took place in the California prison system in the 1960s and the 1970s. And two significant events that happened, the first on August 7, 1970, and the second on August 21, 1971. And that was the killing of Jonathan Jackson in 1970, and then the assassination of George Jackson in 1971. And the different, the brothers in San Quentin and in Lone Park and Soledad Prison, they began to organize to commemorate this struggle and the work and the contribution, particularly of George Jackson. Mm-hmm. And then as that kind of grew over the years, the brothers on the inside, particularly in San Quentin, continued to organize, train with each other, defend themselves against the police guards and against the area Brotherhood, which also worked in collaboration with the police and the state to terrorize, you know, the indigenous, the African, Latino prisoners on the inside. You know, they continued to organize. And in 1978, during one of the kind of key parts of the celebration, one of the other leaders, Katar Galdon, was also, quote unquote, mysteriously killed. And after he was killed, members who have been doing prison solidarity work from primarily, I think, the African People's Party, from RAM, Provisional Government of Public New Africa, took this on the outside to the community to organize defense of these prisoners, but to also commemorate the contribution of Jonathan Jackson and George Jackson and Katar Galdon. Mm-hmm. And from that, people really began to study, because one of the key components of Black August, the study and reflection on the struggle of African resistance. Another piece is the fasting, similar to the Ramadan fast, to kind of also reflect on the discipline and perpetual discipline. And another key component is sharing and studying together as part of the Black August resistance tradition. So that was taken to the broader community in the 1970s as folks were really trying to defend the brothers on the inside, particularly after Qatar, as I mentioned, was killed. And that really kind of set the framework for the Black August tradition. You know, that kind of grew and expanded the public. People were doing more work and more research. It came to uncover, as the years went by, how many significant acts of resistance within the African diaspora in particular happened in the month of August. You know, the Haitian Revolution with the Boaki Yaman and then that whole beginning of the Haitian Revolution that happened in August. You had the Nat Turner Rebellion. You had the different process of rebellion. You know, we can go on and on. All these significant kind of acts of resistance happened in August, and so that really kind of helped us solidify the whole tradition of resistance that we are practicing now and continuing to try to educate younger generations to A, know their history, and to continue the struggle of resistance of our people against white supremacy and colonialism and capitalism.
And so part of what I'm hearing is the rich resistance in the histories of our struggles, and then also a need for reflection in order to move our struggles forward in a way that's accountable and that's also addresses in effective and relevant ways the ways in which Black communities, both continentally and in the diaspora, are dealing and facing the genocidal attacks of white supremacy. And so one of the most interesting and pivotal things that has been happening, particularly in the South, is what you've mentioned was with your work in Jackson, Mississippi, with the newly appointed, elected, Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi. So can you talk a little bit about, because I know that's not something that just happened overnight, about the journey that it took to mobilize the people, what y'all did, the struggles, and also what you've all learned and how you're moving forward from here.
Well, everybody should know that, you know, this is still very much an experiment in progress. But, you know, it took, in many respects, I would say this took about 40 years of work to accomplish, if you really want to look at it, I think, in the totality. And that begins when the provisional members of the provisional government of the Republic of New Africa made a crucial decision in 1971 to move the capital of the Republic down to Mississippi, to a small community outside of Jackson. And Chopra Lumumba was one of the critical youth organizers at that time that supported that move and came down under the leadership of Omar Obadeli to establish the capital of the provisional government of the Republic of New Africa. And Chopra has really been a fixture in Jackson and Mississippi since that time. He's been working as an organizer, working all the different things that we mentioned that our predecessors had been working on as part of the core part of our program. But he also became a trained lawyer and took that and applied those kind of human rights principles that we advocate through his law practice and used it to defend the community over the past 40 years. And so through that work, you know, that's really how he became known as a defender of, you know, particularly the members of the working class, the Black working class in Jackson, defending those who, you know, the court system was targeting, or those who didn't have, you know, any resources to pay for their trial and take some of the hardest cases that nobody would take. He really kind of built his credibility in the community doing that work over the years. But how did the journey really get started in terms of the electoral arena? That started in at least in Jackson, it started in the early 1990s. In the late 80s and early 90s, some of the outgoing white mayors, and Jackson had white mayors until the mid-1990s, they were supporting very actively some of the Klan activity, the Ku Klux Klan activity that was taking place in the late 1980s, including several rallies that took place, Klan rallies that took place in Jackson, Mississippi, in the late 1980s into the early 1990s. And the Malcolm X grassroots movement formed a coalition in 1991 to first start fighting against these kind of Klan incursions and Klan activity that was taking place. And then kind of in conjunction with that, there were several police killings of members of the African community in Jackson in the early 1990s that the same forces were kind of justifying. So, you know, the out of that grew the call for people's assembly. That the Malcolm X grassroots movement and the New African People's Organization organized in 1992. And that first People's Assembly really kind of, I think, following the example of what had recently occurred a couple of years earlier in Chicago that led to the nomination of Harold Washington and eventually the election of Harold Washington in Chicago. People were following that kind of precedent, that model. And they came up with a convention to determine who should be the Black community's candidate for mayor. Should be an African in 1992. And that fundamental coalition has been in place from 1992 to the present. And it eventually wound up electing the first Black mayor of Jackson in 1997. But that mayor very quickly, you know, sided with other forces in the community, determined he was not going to be held accountable to that People's Assembly and that autonomous formation. But we didn't really make a firm decision. I'm just going to jump ahead a little bit. We didn't really make a firm decision to try to run Chopra and other candidates for city council and initially, or for mayor until 2005 after Hurricane Katrina. demographics of Jackson, Mississippi, which is 85% black, and particularly the western part of Mississippi, which we call the Cush District, which is 18 contiguous counties that are predominantly all black, some of them as much as 90% of the population in the county, that we needed to make a concrete struggle for power in these communities, and that's what we've been trying to practice and develop in the Jackson Fish Plan the past 5 years. And the first step was we ran Chokwe for city council in 2009, and we won, and we were using that as kind of a testing ground of, you know, how do we run these campaigns and how do we engage in these activities in a manner which upholds our political principles. So that was kind of an experimental phase in those first 4 years. We decided to run in for mayor about 3 years ago concretely and began doing the work to kind of form a coalition, a broader coalition than just the People's Assembly to try to do that, really starting in 2011. And it was the People's Assembly, which served as the core body of organizing Chokwe's campaign. I mean, we didn't raise a great deal of money. We were outspent by our primary opponent, almost 10-1. We did not have a one-page staff person within the Chokwe Lumumba campaign. It was all volunteer. But we relied on the community organizing work that we've been doing and community, those relationships that we've been building over those 40 years that I mentioned. And we relied on being able to put people in the streets. At any given weekend over the past 2 years, we had over 100 unpaid volunteers who would go knock on every single door in the city of Jackson, just engaging and spreading the word, number one, and engaging in conversation, you know, with the community about what they wanted, what they think was the most vital needs and what was necessary, and then kind of what our vision was based upon the Jackson Fish Plan that we just put out. And, through that work, and I think, being diligent, having, I think, a dynamic strategy of incorporating the core elements of the community, including, you know, a lot of engaging the two critical sectors, that being youth and the elderly, given the composition of how Jackson is structured, where there's a great deal of youth, and then there's a great deal of elder members of the community and folks primarily between the ages of about 20 to about 50, there's a big gap similar to what you see in, I think, a lot of places, communities in the Caribbean and communities in Africa, where those younger folks are generally elsewhere trying to seek life there, right? Jackson is very similar to that in dynamic. But just having that strategy and pulling everything together, we were able to pull off what I think is a very significant electoral win, because there aren't that many liberal or even progressive politicians in the Deep South, let alone folks who have, you know, I think the revolutionary credentials that Chokwe Lumumba has. So we're into our first kind of 100 days of this new administration, and we're learning a great deal in terms of, you know, who our friends are, who our enemies are within the government kind of apparatus on the local and the state level. And that kind of learning curve is going to continue as we just try to, you know, gain our feet and fully implement our program, over the course of the next 4 years and see what we can build in terms of, you know, utilizing the vehicles of state government, you know, in this case, city and municipal government, to further a radical agenda of social transformation in the South. So I would tell folks to just, you know, continue to study the model, stay in touch with us, you know, come down and support if you can, because we want the engagement of our people in this experiment. And we keep saying experiment because it's not like we don't have an experience in Africa and the Caribbean and even significant parts of the United States and some of these urban communities of being a city government. And we know oftentimes that we're not produced the results towards improving the lives of our people. We're trying to do something a little bit different. And it's an experiment. So I want folks to kind of, you know, take it with in that experience, in that frame of reference, I should say, and keep dialoguing with us and struggling with us to hold us accountable to our vision. You know, that's going to be a critical part
we wrap up with you, you'd mentioned that people can keep in touch with you. So let us know, how can people tap into the work that you're doing? Can you drop some websites? Is there anywhere in terms for the, because we're based in Toronto, so folks coming down is going to be a little bit more difficult. But if folks want to follow the work that you're doing, where can they find you?
Yeah. The easiest way you can contact with me is by email. And that's Kali Akuno, AKUNO, at msdm.org by email. You can also reach me on Facebook, same thing, Kali Akuno, KLIAKUNO. For the organization, the best source is to constantly check our website, which is www.mngm.org, for kind of constant information. And to stay up more abreast with what's going on in Jackson, give us about a month to complete a new website that's going to be specifically dedicated to that, called Jackson Live. So, you know, those are the ways that we tell people to kind of stay in contact with our work and that struggle.
Okay. Thank you so much, Kali, for joining the Vibe Collective today and reflecting on Black August. And hopefully we'll be able to talk with you in the next few months and touch base and see what's going on in Jackson.
Look forward to it. Thank
okay.
you.
Free the land.
Okay. We'll be back after these messages on the Vibe Collective CAT 89.5 FM.
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
Come and witness the cinematic genius of Caribbean filmmakers during the 8th Annual Caribbean Tales Film Showcase, running until September 14th at the CNE and Harborfront Center. Feature-length dramas, comedies, musicals, and documentaries will be screened, along with an impressive selection of short films directed by some of the most talented in the region. Learn more about their red carpet gala, free community screening, panel discussions, and video on demand channel at www.caribbeantales-events.com or call 416-743-4000 to purchase tickets.
Ani, Bojo, Tanse, Sego, Wache, and Hello. Indigenous Waves is a celebration of Indigenous cultures, locally, nationally, and globally. Through music, storytelling, interviews, panel discussions, art, and humor, we explore the diversity of Indigenous peoples. Indigenous Waves can be heard here on CIUT every Monday from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you can always catch our podcasts at indigenouswaves.com. Follow us on Twitter at Indigenous Waves to stay up to date with Indigenous Waves here on CIUT 89.5 FM.
And we're back here on the Vibe Collective CIUT 89.5 FM. And if you were tuned in just a little while ago, we were speaking with Kali Akuno from the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement down in Jackson, Mississippi. And thank you, Lam, for running that interview. It was a little difficult to hear all of what he was saying. Yeah. The connection was not the greatest, but it was good to hear from him.
It was good. And yeah, we can always make sure to have him on again later and also have other people on from the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement to just generally talk about the movements around the Black radical tradition, the ways in which Black people have been working around self-determination, the intersectionality of the Black struggle in the United States, and also indigeneity.
Yes.
And also particularly with folks in the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement in New York, looking at how Black people have also been working to intersect the struggles of queer Black people. And so, yeah, there's many different ways that we can connect with folks, with Black folks in the United States that are doing really dope work around freeing the land. Because like KRS-One said, right, there's no justice on stolen land. So
that's exactly right. And that's, as we always bring it back to the intersectionality between Black and Indigenous oppression here on Turtle Island. And that's something that I'm interested in hearing more about. But I do want to hear from Norm, who I think, Norm, you probably have some interesting perspectives on Black August as well. And I know we're going to get to some music in the second hour and you're going to tell a story through music, but maybe you want to throw in some words now and introduce, you know, the topic that you'll be exploring through your playlist in the second hour.
Well, I think it was covered pretty well by Kali Akuno, but Black August, that we know about, basically was started in the California prison system, and Katari Golden was killed in 1978 and 1979, Black August basically started, but Katari Golden has a son that's in California prison right now. And Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, who was from Los Angeles, who was the deputy minister of defense of the Black Panther Party, his brother, his baby brother, is in prison right now in Pelican Bay with, I think, Katari Golden's son. And, you know, Black August basically is spread all over the world now, like South Africa, Cuba. The African People's Socialist Party has a publication, Black Burning Spear. The August issue, which I have in my hand, is dedicated to Black August, but it basically started off in the California prison system. And since that time, people like Mumia Abu-Jamal began to do commentaries on Black August, and he put the Nat Turner piece in, the whole piece about Bookman coming out of coming from Jamaica to Haiti, and so many things took place in August. So basically, what has happened now is that it's an international celebration, but you know it began in the California prison system, and the California prison system is there are more prisoners in California than any other state or any place else on the planet Earth. I grew up in Los Angeles, California, and some of the people that were behind the Black August movement actually grew up in the same neighborhood that I grew up in. And I've had relatives that have, you know, been in the California prison system, and it's a pretty serious situation. But Black August is we've been commemorating it up here basically through radio, and we used to do a lot of events, but it's basically a prisoner movement, and it's good to hear that it's taking place like all over the world. And I think Toronto has is really accepting it now, I can see.
So now, because it's a prisoner movement, do you think that there are do you see room for dialogue, as we were mentioning earlier, and Luam alluded to it, between the struggles of Black and Indigenous people, specifically here in Canada, where those two populations are the most overrepresented within the prison industrial complex up here? What is becoming a prison industrial complex up here in Canada?
Of course, because the Native people Native people, First Nations people here, and Native people in the United States have links with one another. My grandmother, who was born in Mississippi, Choctaw. I mean, she was. I remember meeting my great-grandmother, Ms. Glover. She was half Choctaw. And most African people in the United States have indigenous roots anyway. Now, I know many great musicians. Like, there's a guy by the name of Don Cherry who used to play with Arnett Coleman. There's another guy by the name of a guitar player. I can't think of his name. But these guys actually grew up in Los Angeles, California, with a African mother and a Native father or something like that. So we have cultures together. And we have always, I mean, the progressive forces have always tried to align with African and the Latinos and the Native people. I think that we as a people, when I say African people in the United States, the indigenous question has not been on the agenda, as it's not as high as it should be, because like I say, we have all these personal links. But when you hear the dialogue about the United States, we basically hear African and Latino and African and Asian. You know, but the fact is that many of us, most of us have actually have blood roots with indigenous people.
And I find it really interesting because, and the reason why I want to bring this into the dialogue is because, you know, part of the agenda of, you know, white supremacy has been erasure, the erasure of indigenous people in particular from you know, land, from education, from history. And then, you know, we see that happening with the solidarity movements. There's particularly, I think, in the United States, I think there is a bit of a difference up here in Canada, but from, you know, talking to activists and organizers down in the States, this is what I hear consistently, is that, yeah, that is definitely often absent, the indigenous struggle, and just sort of indigenous solidarity is often absent from the dialogue.
True. Mm-hmm. I think also, though, that it's important that we understand, one, there has been and continues to still be intersections and ways in which the Black radical tradition has included indigeneity, particularly of Turtle Island, in its movements. You look at the collaboration of AIM and the Black Panthers, and in the ways in which the Black radical tradition has supported and continues to support indigenous political prisoners. I also think, though, it's important, and it's not an easy distinction to make between African peoples and then indigenous peoples. Like, I think what Norm is trying to inject into the discourse and into the conversation that we're having is that those distinctions aren't always separate, that there's a lot of in-between and interrelation that happens. And so when we're talking about, and this is something that I think we could always do better at in our struggles collectively, is when we're talking about oppressions that we talked about, we talk about the ways in which they're linked, the ways in which the genocidal attacks of indigenous peoples on Turtle Island through residential school systems works hand in hand with the prison industrial complex, and the ways in which Black peoples are the base and the backbone of that, and that it's an extension of chattel slavery. And it's an extension of making sure that slavery is still legal, and that Black people's bodies are used as modes of capital primarily, and that the ways in which then that intersects and relates to the push of the model minority, which Vijay Prashad talks about, and the ways in which people of color are given room to move because they're not Black. And so I think those are the things, and I think that's what the beauty of Black August is that it allows us to stop and reflect. For me, that's always been the main thing about Black August that differs it from other movements or other collective ways of thinking, is that it's asking you to stop and to think, and what are we doing in our struggles? How can we move forward in better and accountable ways? And so I think, yeah, the conversation could be stronger and could be better, but it's not absent. I think that there's many people, Black radical organizers in the United States and here, who are talking about the links with indigeneity and who also recognize the ways in which those two struggles are inherent to each other in our visions of freedom.
I think that this brother by the name of Dakinjewa, he came to Toronto and stayed here for a second. He was in Attica. He was a native. He was a native, but I hope he's still in the land of the living. But he was here with us for a while. He was in Attica when everything went down, and he had good links with you know, the people in inside the prisons. But I know, like, inside the, like, George Jackson had a good relationship with a brother by the name of Hugo Pinel. Hugo Pinel is out of Nicaragua. Hugo Pinel speaks Spanish and English. And Hugo Pinel is mixed up with everything, African, indigenous. And I find that the prison movement always saw the more so, than, in many cases, better than those people that were outside of prison, had an international outlook. And someone like George Jackson always tried to keep saying, okay, we're in prison. The enemy is the guards. These white folks in here are, they could be Nazis or whatever, but we should even try to neutralize them to fight against the system, and everyone should come together. And that was why he was, you know, he was murdered. And that's why the California movement now, the prison movement, is so powerful, because they have been able to unite all of these elements together. And that's why the hunger strike is taking place. And it is there's probably more unity on the inside of the prison movement than there is on the outside.
I mean, it's interesting to consider the difference between solidarity on the inside, as you say, in particular, you know, when you have these groups that are often portrayed, you know, in media and in film as being very, very secular. Like, you know, you've got within the prison, you've got people who, you know, will sort of divide along very racialized lines, politicized as well. And what you're saying is that, in fact, there is often a sort of neutralization of that, of those divisions, in solidarity of the fact that everybody on the inside is being oppressed by.
And they can see it quicker, better. I mean, because it's a. Racism is a tool of the system, and they can use it inside the prisons easier than they. I mean, I lived in California for the first 20 years of my life, and I grew up with Chicanos, a few Asians, and so on and so forth. There was never antagonistic contradictions. I have an aunt who is 95 years old who came to California when she was, she came in 1947, and she talked about living in California. There were no antagonistic contradictions in the 40s. The contradictions now have become contradictions, they are antagonistic because of the drug trade. It's a whole question of who's going to control the drugs in California. The Latinos, first of all, the African people are, you know, primarily Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, coming from that situation. But then there's people from all over the world. African people have come there. So you have that. But then you have the Latinos who are Chicano, people from Mexico who are. The Chicanos are the people that are born in the United States. The Mexicans come there. Then you have people from Guatemala who are very, very. Some of the Latinos are super duper 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 political and leading the trade union movement. So, you know, basically the contradiction, the system is trying to create a split between all of these particular movements. And there's a lot of, if you read a lot of the internet situation, you know, somebody, they say that the Mexicans kill the blacks in Compton, and they do a whole number on that. But basically that is, you know, it has a lot to do with the drug trade. And like I say, it has never been, I didn't grow up that way. It was like we coexisted with everyone. 1965, the rebellion was African people, basically, and in 1992, it was Latinos with a little support from the African community, and but the demographics have changed tremendously in Los Angeles.
Norm, can you talk about how Black August has moved out of California? And I know that, you know, with some of the music that you're going to be playing coming up at the 4 o'clock hour, you'll be looking at, you know, what's happening in on the other side of the planet over in England. Can you talk about how the connection, first of all, between here and, you know, here in North America and in England with Black August?
Well, the first person I think that did a song about Black August was Archie Shepp, who was from Florida, and he did a song about George Jackson in 1972. But then Steel Pulse, I believe they're out of Birmingham, England, They came to Canada in 1981, 1982. They came to the concert hall, and I actually introduced them the first time they came to the city. And they did George Jackson. They covered Bob Dylan's George Jackson. Then they did Uncle George, and then they did a song called Tribute to the Martyrs. But for some reason, the Steel Pulse, David Hines and his group were fascinated with George Jackson, and they have been talking about George Jackson, and they have a song about Trayvon Martin. But the Steel Pulse, they are one of the more political groups that have dealt with George Jackson, and they have a very international outlook. Like, they deal with issues of England, the United States, Africa, Canada. You know, they are the ones that did it. But Bob Dylan, I have to give him credit, although he is does a lot of backsliding. He talked about George Jackson. Yeah, he recorded, I think he did a big band version of George Jackson, then he did his other song. And he did a lot of great work, but he's backsliding on a number of issues. But so you had Archie, then you had a film. Warner Brothers cashed in on, they did a film on George Jackson starring Bernie Casey, who was a football player, and the late Vanetta McGee. Vanetta McGee played Angela, and Bernie Casey played George, and the music was done by Taj Mahal. And I saw that film in Memphis, Tennessee. There were three people in the theater: myself, and an elder Euro-American couple. And it was I liked the film, but a lot of people didn't like it. But I thought it was, I would recommend people see it. But it was a Warner Brothers film, and it was attempting to capitalize on the passing of George Jackson and
exploitation at the time too. Not so much.
They were trying to make money, of course. Yeah, but I'm just saying, I don't think George's mother appreciated. Georgia Jackson was, she's pretty hardcore.
What'd you think about George Jackson in the Angela Davis documentary that came out last year?
I didn't see it.
What do you think about it, Adrian?
What? Oh, no, I was just, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about this issue to make a critique. I'll leave it at that.
George Jackson was a very intelligent man. Mm. I mean, when he got killed, they found I think it was 101 books in his cell.
They just released a list of books that were in his cell recently. Yeah. I think it's the first time that's ever been released after years of work around it.
Well, he was a bookworm, mm-hmm. and a fitness freak, but he read. This is even before he went when he first started when he went into juvenile hall. He was always a bookman. Mm-hmm. You know, he started off as a nationalist and was into Marcus Garvey big time. He was talking about, you know, he wanted to break out of prison and take a ship to Africa and come back and free black folks. And you know, then he discovered, he said he discovered, you know, socialism with the rest of the third world. And then he changed his views, or didn't change his views, but he thought that he had given up on black people in America. But then he said that, you know, we can make a revolution here. And he started concentrating on organizing inside prison.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say that when I saw the Angela Davis documentary, it was... Who was it? Was Will Smith that? Yeah, it's Will and Jada Pinkett Smith put that together, and it didn't really get into much of that. It was kind of like just romance between she and George Jackson, mm-hmm. you know. And it didn't much get into the kind of politics. He was just kind of like this, you know, kind of the way that it was portrayed is kind of like he's just kind of like imprisoned exotic radical, you know, which is an image you see kind of. played over again, like you're watching the Felicia Keys videos or what have you, right? You see that idea, but you don't really get into so much his. I don't recall him getting much into his ideas and his transformation as it You know, obviously the documentary was about her, but it was like also, you know, in kind of conversation with that. Yeah.
Which is not surprising, right? Because when you look at the ways in which black men are depicted in mainstream media, mm-hmm. it's either exotified, thug, or dead.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Or mostly dead,
you know. And, you know, we can laugh about it, but it's true. And there's a reason why George Jackson was executed, because of his, not only his ability to provide critical interventions into the ways that we thought around blackness and the ways that we understood organizing, but also because he was building bridges. And it's something that we can come back to in the show that we talked about last week, about the danger of building bridges. And that's when the state, and that's when mainstream media and all of the apparatuses of the state will then come in with everything that they have. Because when they see communities coming and building together and those struggles interconnecting, then sure. So that's for me, it's not a surprise that his political prowess was completely removed.
But it wasn't exactly that. Well, I mean, it did have this kind of like universalist, kind of radical human, you know, glaze to the whole documentary.
But that's part of it. Like, let's depict it as a crazy...
It wasn't... No, I mean, that was, like, the idea. But it wasn't really... it wasn't... I mean, when I go see an Angela Davis documentary, I'm not thinking mainstream media. You know, perhaps by naivete. Mm-hmm. Right? But it was like, so you're expecting something that's going to have more... I guess, I don't want to say depth, because there was a certain depth to it, and there's a certain thoroughness to it. Mm-hmm. But in that, I didn't leave thinking I really knew this person.
Yeah. I wish I could.
I just wanted to talk. Because I saw the documentary as well, and I was really disappointed in it, but not surprised that I was disappointed in it. But basically, if you looked at the doc, it was one interview. They only did one interview with her, and it was splattered throughout the documentary, and the rest was sort of like this characterization of Angela and, yeah, basically her relationship with George. So there was nothing really that I got from the documentary that I didn't already know. Mm. And sort of like, you know, I guess exploring the myth of sort of that time. But yeah, there was no... Yeah,
it was like a good old American story.
Yeah.
You know, so like the idea of how like these traditions of quote-unquote radicalism get kind of, you know, re-rendered in this, you know, Americanistic glaze, using sometimes radical people. Because, I mean, you know, Angela Davis was a symbol for, you know, the black radical tradition for, well, I mean, she obviously had critiques of it, but, like, to some degree you saw that. And yet, you know, this remembrance is completely divorced from the things that Norman's here talking about, or the things that Callie was talking about, in a sense.
Well, I knew there's a brother by the name of Kumasi who grew up in the same neighborhood that I grew up with and was in prison with George Jackson. He said he loved it. I want to see the documentary. He said he loved it, but he was very critical of Angela Davis till he saw this particular documentary. He used to talk about Angela bad. Then when he saw Angela, he was talking about how Angela's father had been participating in the self-defense things in Birmingham, Alabama. But I want to see it. I want to see it for myself. But there's a documentary where there is a redneck prisoner, a real racist prisoner, white guy, who they tried to get to kill George Jackson in prison. And he basically says he could not do it because after he thought about George and heard about George, he said the man was... He made more sense. It didn't make any sense to hurt George because George was making more sense than the system. So basically, George neutralized, you know, this particular... I'm gonna have to go find which documentary that was. But this was a you know, one of the so-called bad rednecks that they said we'll get him, and he'll, you know, he's, you know, tough enough to go after George. But when he said he thought about it, he said, this man is like fighting for all of us. And, you know, he could see that.
Well, we're just at the end of our hour. I've got to go to some ads. And then when we come back on the other side, Norm, you've got some tunes that you're going to play. And
yes,
you'll be telling a story along with those tunes.
Yes.
Which we're all very excited about. So for the listeners, you're listening to The Vibe Collective. And I want to give thanks to Luam for bringing in Kali Akanu from Jackson, Mississippi. The Malcolm X grassroots movement was on the phone with us earlier talking about Black August. We do have Norman Otis Richmond in studio with us right now. And we're going to go to some ads. And when we come back, Norm is going to play some tunes and continue the dialogue around Black August here on the Vibe Collective CIUT 89.5 FM.
Urbane Cyclist specializes in...